You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Today we're joined by Casey Winters, an author, illustrator, and retired educator. Her extraordinary research, artistic talent, and personal dedication to an important but little-known story from World War II produced the book One Balloon, Silent Attack on the American Homeland. Well, this isn't your typical war story. On May 5, 1945, tragedy struck the quiet community of Bly, a tiny community in southeastern Oregon, when a Japanese balloon bomb exploded, claiming the lives of six people, the only fatalities from enemy action on the continental United States during the entire war. For KC, this isn't just a historical footnote, it's family history. One of the victims was her aunt, Elsie Mitchell, who was pregnant with her first child at the time. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Casey.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed just meeting you already. This is going to be so much fun, I can tell.
Well, it will be. You're going to help me understand all of this story, and you're going to help our listeners as well. Now, you were 3 years old when your Aunt Elsie was killed by this balloon bomb during World War II. How did you learn about this story?
I didn't know my Aunt Elsie at all because I was three when she died, and I just don't remember any of it. But I grew up hearing the story off and on throughout the years. In fact, it became one of the family around the campfire stories, you know. My dad would always bring it up, but there were never any details. It was always just sort of, okay, it's part of our family.
Well, for listeners who may not be familiar with this story, let's set the scene for that day in May 1945. What was the group doing, and how did they inadvertently encounter this weapon?
My Aunt Elsie was 5 months pregnant and had been sick during the pregnancy and had chosen not to go on the picnic because of her sickness. And one of the little children from the group of the church picnic.
So this was a church picnic?
Yes. Okay. It was a Sunday school church picnic.
In the town of Bly, Oregon.
In the town of Bly, Oregon. And Elsie had decided not to go, but one of the children convinced her that going on the picnic with the rest of the kids would be a great thing. So at the last minute, she changed her mind and went on the picnic.
Okay, so this was a planned church picnic, and they went out to where?
They went out into the forest up toward Gearhart Mountain near Bly, and they came across a road grader that had blocked the road. They had planned to go to a special fishing place where the kids had said they wanted to take Archie, and Archie was Elsie's husband, take them up there to see this really cool place. The road was blocked. They had to turn the car around, and Archie said to the children and to Elsie, "Why don't you get out here? Go find a place. We can't go any farther, and I'll bring the picnic basket." And the kids and Elsie went into the forest and came upon an object in a tree, and one of them apparently touched it, and it exploded and killed them all instantly. So.
And Archie was still with the car at the time.
Archie was still at the car, and he witnessed the whole thing. It was, you know, real close distance to where it happened. And he and the road crew men ran down to the site and put out the fires, and that was the end of all of them. So that's what started the story, was the event.
And so at some point, you decided to write a book about this. Now, that wasn't right away.
No, that wasn't right away. That was 40-some-plus years later.
So what happened that inspired you or prompted you to begin this project?
I went to visit my Aunt Thelma, who happens to be Elsie's younger sister. When Elsie was killed, Thelma started collecting newspaper articles, memorabilia, pictures, telegrams, letters. She had this album about, 2 feet deep of all of this over the years. And I inherited it. She gave it to me, actually, loaned it to me. Take this home if you want to and organize it. And I did that. And, all the tattered pages everything was falling apart because it had been a long, long time since my aunt had put the album together. So I started organizing the articles and putting everything in chronological order. And then I one day just picked up a pencil and started sketching something from what I had read, because there was no picture in the album of it, but an image came to my mind.
So we should note that you're also an artist.
Oh, yes. you should note that.
Quite an accomplished artist.
Oh, thank you.
This book is illustrated by you.
Correct.
And it's absolutely fantastic.
I appreciate that comment. Thank you so much.
So around this time, yes, you began to put all these artifacts together, all of these pieces of information, and began to sketch.
Yes. In fact, the whole book was sketched and painted before it was before I put the text in, or the narrative. What is that called?
So the visuals were put together before you started to write.
Right. Correct.
Around what time was this?
How old was I?
Around what year or what age?
Oh, dear. What age? Let's see. It was like 17 years ago, so subtract that from 84.
Okay.
So what age was I?
This was a little later in your life.
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, this was after I had retired from teaching and after I had lived in France and Spain for a while. Yeah. I started this story, actually, when I think back a little bit. I did start this story when I lived in France, and that was in 2007.
Okay. My guest is K.C. Winters. She's the author and illustrator of a fascinating book titled One Balloon, Silent Attack on the American Homestead. She'll talk more about her book at the Rogue Valley Metaphysical Library in Ashland at 7 p.m. tonight. More information can be found at winterswest.studio.com. So K.C., as a researcher and a family member, what are your thoughts about how that initial cover-up by the government affected the way the victims were remembered, or rather forgotten, by the public?
Well, that cover-up, that was one of the most intense things for me when I was pulling the book together, is coming across all of the cover-ups. In my research, I found so many cover-up stories. And that basically drove that part of whatever your question was.
So it really motivated you to bring this story to life.
Yes.
Well,
that was one of the motivations. There were so many, because it is a personal story, a family story, and I think the thing that hit me the strongest, besides the government cover-ups, was the intensity of the forgiveness and the things that people did to give their and share their forgiveness.
So now we're talking about this coming together of the Japanese people who made a pilgrimage to Oregon? Is that what we're talking about, or are we talking about the people that were affected in Bly from the explosion? When you say forgiveness, who's forgiving
I'm talking about forgiveness on both sides. My
phone. And that's fine. So forgiveness on both sides.
Right.
What I want to do is get into this story so we do what your book does. It takes us in a chronological order, and you even have a beautifully illustrated timeline in your book that helps understand this story from beginning to finish. But the story is well put together so that anyone who doesn't know it can understand what happened, you know, starting with the war effort, and you have the U.S. government, lots of propaganda, such as, you know, everyone needs to join the war effort. You need to raise hens and raise pigs for the war effort and victory gardens. Tell us about that. You lived through that.
I lived through that. I lived through it only vicariously through my research. The propaganda part of the story is real significant. It's like all of the events that happened, you know, the, during the war with the women that were staying at home and picking up on the jobs of the men that had gone off to war, and Uncle Sam telling everybody this is how you need to be living and doing it, and they were doing it and following along, and it was from what I've read, I didn't actually. Well, I mean, I might have lived through this part, but I was really young, and I don't remember that part. But it's amazing to just think of having to live that way and how everybody picked up and participated, contributed.
They were all doing their patriotic duty.
Thank you. That's exactly what I needed to say.
Now, at the same time that Americans were doing their patriotic duty, you tell the story of a young boy who, unbeknownst to him what was happening, was picked up with his family and taken to a Japanese internment camp. Tell me about that.
Do you want to know about Yusuro or the internment camp and
yes.
all of it together? Yusuro was a, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, I'm sorry, it could be Yusuro. It was a teenage boy who had worked in, he had, as a young man, had gone to Japan and lived with his grandparents. He was a Japanese-American boy. And he became trained and cultured in the Japanese language, excuse me, and returned back to the United States to, you know, kind of just be a normal Japanese-American young boy living his life. And Pearl Harbor broke out, and the everybody of Japanese heritage were incarcerated into American concentration camps, which I believe were called internment camps back in the day. I mean, I know they were back in the day. Seems like the terminology has changed.
You tell the story of him being taken to Tule Lake.
Yes.
Where there wasn't a lake, ironically.
Right. Tule Lake was yes. one of the internment camps.
Let's hold it right there because we have to take a short break.
Okay.
But when we come back, we'll pick it up with Yusuri at Tule Lake. My guest is Casey Winters. She's the author and illustrator of One Balloon, Silent Attack on the American Homestead. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is K.C. Winters. She's the author and illustrator of an extraordinary book titled One Balloon, Silent Attack on the American Homestead. K.C. Winters will talk more about her book at the Rogue Valley Metaphysical Library in Ashland at 7 p.m. tonight. More information on additional appearances in Klamath Falls and Bly this weekend can be found on our website at jeffexchange.org. So before the break, we were talking about Yuzuru, or Yuzuru, and this Japanese boy who had come back from Japan and was here with his family, and that's when they were taken into these concentration camps, and his family went to Tule Lake.
Correct. And this all happened right after Pearl Harbor. Yes. So at Tule Lake, he lives the life of internment, which is unbearable in many, many ways. And, of course, everybody is confused and nobody knows what's happening. And he's just a young teenager. So the chapter on Yuzuru is basically just his experience in the internment, a daily life thing. It was amazing when I was doing the research on it. I just kind of found it hard to believe that they would have to go through all of the things that happened. Anyway.
So what was the significance of his realization decades later at the Smithsonian regarding the balloons he might have seen while behind barbed wire?
Okay, so one day, there was a rumor that came through the internment camp that the Japanese had sent thousands of balloons over full of kamikaze pilots and germ warfare and chemicals and all that. That turned out to be a rumor, but Yuzuru was real interested in the concept, and he watched the skies, something to just keep him busy, I guess. And one day he thought he saw a balloon, and he told his teacher, and she said, well, you know, there is a rumor, but the rumors died, and Yuzuru kept the idea in his mind forever, I guess. 42 years later, he becomes a professor out in Michigan, and he takes his class to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum just on a field trip, and they see an exhibit of the balloon. And when he sees the exhibit of the balloon, he's reminded of back in the days of Tule Lake as a young man and thinks, wow, maybe that is the balloon that I thought I saw going over the mountains. And he writes down the names of the people that were killed by the balloon, which were, excuse me, my aunt and the five children. And he tucks it in his pocket, and then he goes off to Japan on an exchange where he's teaching English at a college there, a sabbatical. And he runs into an old friend that he had while he was in Japan, and they get together and start talking about this internment and about the balloons that Yuzuru thought he saw. And his friend's wife, Reiko, gets up and goes into the closet and pulls out a treasure chest, more or less, and opens it and reveals the remnants of her experiences as a young girl in Japan on a secret island making the balloons.
She was conscripted as a child to make these balloons.
Yes, she and I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of children. Yes, they were taken into the, what they called generally the Japanese Children's Army. And they were trained to kill the enemy. And they didn't know that the enemy was the Americans. They just knew there was an enemy out there.
Okay, and so both sides, the United States is having our people build victory gardens and, you know, save scrap metal and for the war effort. And on their side, young people were helping to build the materials or create the materials and piece them together for these balloons that would be filled with helium and then sent through the Gulf Airstream over into the United States. Now, there were thousands of these balloons, right?
Yes. They were filled with hydrogen. There were the Japanese girls within 5 months made 10,000 30-foot in diameter balloons with generally there were about 5 bombs attached to each one.
And many of them made it to the U.S. mainland, and you have that listed in your book.
Correct. They out of the 10,000 that they made, they launched 9,000. And research has shown that approximately maybe 400 actually reached North America. And North America being all the way up as far as you can go up into Alaska, they found balloons, and as far south into mid-Mexico, and as far east as Farmington, Michigan. But most of them landed around the Oregon area. Most of them kind of dismantled before they really ever got here. A lot of them landed prematurely in the Pacific. They had to travel 6,000 miles across the Pacific Ocean in the jet stream.
And there were news reports about this, but not for long.
Yes. that's correct. Not for long. The government put a censorship on it right away, basically. Can't remember exactly what stage, but they had radar stations out looking for the balloons, and they had planes that they were trying to shoot them down, and they were a little bit too elusive, and so they had paratroopers jumping into the forests to put out fires, and they cautioned people, if you see anything, don't talk about it and don't tell anybody, and we don't want the enemy to know, and we don't want the public to panic. So they covered it up. And the media agreed. Everybody, newspapers and radios, and it's like, okay, we're not going to talk about this.
My guest is Casey Winters. She's the author and illustrator of One Balloon, Silent Attack on the American Homestead. She'll talk more about her book at the Rogue Valley Metaphysical Library in Ashland at 7 p.m. tonight. Now, Casey, in 1987 and 1990, Japanese women who had worked on those balloons traveled to Oregon to offer peace cranes and plant trees. What did that pilgrimage of reconciliation, what does it tell you, what does it tell us about the human spirit's capacity to heal across generations?
That's a really hard question.
Is that still going on? Is that relationship still being repaired?
I think so. And I think probably through this book, partly, I mean, it's like the friendship that these women, the Japanese women, well, let me back up a little bit. Once Yusuro had the names of the people that were killed in his pocket, my aunt and the five children. He went on like this pilgrimage, a personal one, to be sure that those five children and my Aunt Elsie were remembered. And he wanted more than anything to have the friendship between the Japanese and the Americans healed. And that, I think, that's his mission. He gathered all the women that he could find. He went to Japan and reunited with his friend. His friend was married to one of the girls that had been a balloon bomb maker, and she gathered her alumni, I guess you'd say, together. And
you included her in the book.
Yes. Yes. Reiko. There's a whole chapter on her experience in the Japanese Army, Children's Army, and making the balloons. Yeah, and it's really quite graphic. Because now, every page basically is an illustration.
It's an easy read. It's filled with beautiful visuals, but it's also filled with a number of memorabilia. You've got newspaper clippings. You've got photos from your family albums. You've got letters that were written.
Yes. There were a lot of things in that album. Well, there still are. The album still exists.
Well, yeah. You've been back to the site, and you've described Bly as a quiet, sacred place. For those who visit, there's a monument, I'm assuming. For those who visit that place today, what do you think or what do you hope they'll take away from seeing the gifts and the peace cranes and the things that are still there?
I would hope that they have a memory and a reverence and an interest in reading the story and the the memory of all of it through the book. Does that make sense?
It does, because that memory was squashed. That memory was taken away from us by the U.S. government and its censorship, and then it was never repaired. It was we're not learning about this in ways that we ought to in our schools and in our public square.
Correct. I'm glad you brought that up, because I would love to see the book get put into history classes, middle school, high school, college. I mean, it's a part of history that I don't think is in any history book.
And it's extremely well done. So this book could be the catalyst for building, an American memory that was taken away from us. And generations could be reminded of what happened right here in Oregon and how that relationship between Japan and America is still being repaired.
Yes. Very well put.
Where can our listeners find your book? I know you have a website. What's your website's? Winterweststudio.com. Now, I know people can go there and get more information.
Correct. Or they can contact me directly at 312-622-8022, but I'm sure not very many people have a pencil right there to write that down.
Well, we'll have this information on our website at jeffexchange.org. That's the only thing they'll have to worry about. But we're out of time. Thank you so much, Casey, for the work that you put into creating this treasure for generations.
Oh, and thank you so much for the opportunity to share it. And to meet you. It was wonderful.
My guest was Casey Winters, author and illustrator of One Balloon, Silent Attack on the American Homestead. She'll be giving an author's talk in Ashland this evening at the Rogue Valley Metaphysical Library at 7 p.m.